Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight.
I think what's been clear is that over many decades, one of the unmet needs has been that despite those drugs being available, I think it's pretty fair to say that they've sort of fallen a little bit short in terms of their efficacy at making patients feel better and function better with obstructive HCM.
Today, Drs. Marin and Rowan join the podcast to discuss obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, the role of septal reduction therapy in the current era of cardiac myosin inhibitors, in this PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative supporters.
Hello, I am Dr. Martin Marin, Director of the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Center at Lahey Hospital and Medical Center and Associate Professor of Medicine at the University of Massachusetts School of Medicine.
Hi, I'm Dr. Ethan Rowan, Co-Director of the Hypertrophic Cardiomyopathy Center at Lahey Hospital and Medical Center and Associate Professor of Medicine at UMass School of Medicine.
So, Ethan, let's start with this. So for those that are listening who are evaluating patients with HCM, that are seeing patients particularly with symptomatic HCM, that's what we're going to focus on now. Tell us a little bit about your approach to how we can achieve what are really the primary treatment goals for patients with obstructive HCM, which is to make them feel better and function better. What's your approach been and where do we stand with that right now?
Yeah. Historically, when we've had symptomatic patients with obstructive HCM, we'd really start by treating them with beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, to see if we could help mitigate symptoms with them. In the past, if those drugs have failed, that's when we would move on to invasive procedures, either with a surgical myectomy or an alcohol ablation. Surgical myectomy being open heart surgery, where a surgeon would go in, shave down thick heart muscle, address any mitral valve abnormalities contributing to obstruction, and relieve obstruction, while alcohol septal ablation, percutaneous procedure done by an interventional cardiologist, where they'd isolate the first septal perforator, inject alcohol into that and cause thinning of the thick heart muscle to relieve obstruction.
Right. So good. So we've had some drugs and we've had some invasive options, and we'll get a little bit more into those maybe in a minute. But I think what's been clear is that over many decades, one of the unmet needs has been that despite those drugs being available, I think it's pretty fair to say that they've sort of fallen a little bit short in terms of their efficacy at making patients feel better and function better with obstructive HCM. And for that reason, there's been an unmet need in terms of medical therapy for that symptomatic obstructive patient. And I think that was really one of the impetus for the evolution and emergence, I should say, of a novel group of drugs called cardiac myosin inhibitors. First in man was mavacamten, as approved by the FDA in 2022 for the treatment of symptomatic obstructive HCM. And now more recently, we've got a second in class called aficamten, recently approved for the same indication by the FDA just a few months ago. So we've got two drugs that are cardiac myosin inhibitors. Both of those work in a pretty similar way, right, mechanistically. They target the structural apparatus of the heart muscle, the sarcomere, by decreasing the interactions of the myosin head and actin filament. Those are the structural proteins of the cardiac sarcomere. And essentially, by doing that, these drugs modulate or decrease the contractility of the heart, right? And by decreasing the contractility of the heart, you're influencing one of the most important reasons why patients with HCM develop obstruction, because it's that hypercontractility that goes to helping to push that valve in toward the septum and create the impedance to blood flow and the pressure gradient. So by decreasing the contractility, you can lower or in many cases actually abolish the obstruction, normalizing the pressures. And that is really what translates into significant clinical benefit for patients, correct?
Absolutely. Really well-designed randomized control trials for both of those drugs, which have really shown that for the majority of patients, you can eliminate obstruction and make them feel better by improving either NYHA class and also measures of functional capacity by cardiopulmonary exercise testing.
Yes, yeah, so let's talk about that a little bit more. So I think what you know, if we could summarize sort of the experience with both mavacamten and aficamten to date, it's that, you know, through, as you said, a number of clinical trials, these drugs have been tested for both their efficacy and safety. And I think, you know, we can say at this point that there's a substantial amount of evidence to demonstrate that these drugs do what they were intended to do. They lower the pressure gradients in many patients, in some cases completely abolish those gradients completely. And by doing that, that is really translating into a significant clinical benefit with substantial improvements in symptom improvement. Okay, but the proportion of patients, for example, that are improving by one or more NYHA class, approaching about 60 to 70% of patients on those drugs. And then also patients are functioning better. And the way we've been measuring that in the trials is using cardiopulmonary exercise testing with that peak VO2 measurement. And we're seeing increases in peak VO2 with the myosin inhibitors that are significant, exceeding the 1 mL/kg/min kind of threshold of what we've considered to be a clinically meaningful improvement in functional capacity. And so, and in addition, by the way, as well, and important too, is that the biomarker NT-proBNP are substantially reduced as well, kind of demonstrating, I think, that you are, in fact, lowering those LV pressures to a substantial amount, that marker of intracardiac pressure is also substantially lowered. And so you've got a lot of evidence here with these drugs that patients are feeling better and functioning better. And I think a lot of that's driven by the significant reduction in the gradient using both either of those two drugs. And again, that goes back to the way these drugs work by decreasing contractility. Now, with that said, of course, you know, it's important to realize that that these drugs have to be, if they're being used, they have to be used in a certain kind of way, right? They have to be, patients have to agree to sort of a certain degree of monitoring that comes with that. So why don't you tell us a little bit about, one, why do we have that and what does that kind of look like?
With these drugs, it's affecting cardiac contractility. So one of the major concerns is that systolic function on the drugs can actually drop to a point where, if unrecognized, could be potentially dangerous. So in the clinical trials, a subset of between 3.5 to 10% of patients with either of the cardiac myosin inhibitors, systolic function dropped. And therefore, to help mitigate any risk to patients, both drugs were approved with a REMS program, restricted access monitoring program, to really make sure that we're monitoring patients on the drugs correctly. And then if there is any evidence that this for systolic dysfunction, then we can either timely stop the drugs or decrease the dose. And when you stop the drug, the systolic function ejection fraction goes back to normal.
Right. Okay, good. So patients have to, you know, commit to that kind of monitoring for safety, of course. And again, that risk of systolic dysfunction and potential heart failure is a black box warning on the label for both of these drugs. It's a class effect. And so that's important for both prescribers and patients to understand. With that said, maybe we can just touch on the second in class drug, aficamten. As we said, that also has a REMS program associated with it. It's a little bit distinct than what we've been used to up to this point as well. And I think one of the distinctions of aficamten, and I think it's important to sort of talk about that for a second, is it has a little bit of a different pharmacology profile, which kind of leads to the reason I think why we see a little bit different kind of REMS program with it. I'll touch on just a couple of those points, and you can then translate that into what that means for the REMS program for aficamten. One is that aficamten has a short half-life, or relatively short half-life, of about 3.5 days, which means that each steady state in 2 weeks. So just to kind of make that simple, that just means that you can titrate up as soon as 2 weeks on the dose of aficamten. And that's important because you can, again, kind of go up on the dose to achieve clinical benefit with a relatively short period of time, 2 weeks. That's the window because of the pharmacology there. And it's eliminated relatively rapidly too. And so you can, if there is a certain low EF situation, usually between 40 and 50% EF, if that occurs on aficamten, then you can down titrate without having to sort of interrupt dosing. That's another important, I think, point. Again, leveraging that pharmacology of aficamten as well here. In addition, very little drug-drug interactions associated with aficamten as well. In fact, the only drug you can't use with aficamten is rifampin as well. And so maybe you could just touch on sort of for those that are considering using these drugs for their patients, you know, what then does that sort of mean for the monitoring program if a patient were to engage with aficamten?
Yeah. So the REMS program for aficamten is relatively lenient. So you start the drug, you start at 5 milligrams, and then the requirement is that a patient comes back for an echo between 2 and 8 weeks. So there's a really wide range when they can come back, which gives a lot of flexibility for the patients and the providers to get them in. They have a repeat echo. And then based on what that repeat echo shows, you can even start up titrating the drug after potentially 2 weeks to get them on a therapeutic dose that they need.
Right.
And that up titration is based on where their ejection fraction is and then if they still have residual outflow gradients.
That's great. Yeah. So a little bit more flexibility on when those echoes need to be done, 2 to 8 weeks. I think that flexibility, by the way, is sort of a patient-centric thing. I think that helps to sort of allow patients to have a little bit more opportunity to engage here with that kind of degree of flexibility as well. Maybe you could just mention, you know, the REMS program associated with mavacamten for a minute, just so everybody understands sort of what that may look like as well.
Yeah, with mavacamten, the REMS is start the drug and then you have an echo essentially a month after, at which point you either would keep the same dose or if there's a clear reduction in outflow gradients, would actually drop the dose. Mm-hmm. And then you're doing that monthly until month three. At month three, if they have an outflow gradient, you can start up titrating.
So Ethan, another sort of important point here. You know, we've talked about the cardiac myosin inhibitor drug therapies, their efficacy here and how they are currently integrated into the guidelines as an add-on therapy, right? So add-on therapy. So just again, symptomatic obstructive HCM patients, generally we're still starting beta blocker or calcium channel blocker. If those aren't successful at improving patient symptoms or patients have side effects, then that's where the CMI or cardiac myosin inhibitor option then becomes available, right? So One point about that is that they, you know, we've been using beta blockers, for example, as first-line therapy, you know, for probably half a century, with actually very little evidence around the efficacy of that drug. Okay, there haven't been really any prospective trials with beta blocker and obstructive HCM. We've been using it largely because of expert opinion, but also there hasn't really been any other options medically to use either. Okay. With the success of the cardiac myosin inhibitors, there was a recent trial called MAPLE-HCM, which evaluated initial monotherapy with aficamten versus initial monotherapy with metoprolol beta blocker to determine whether there was potentially a efficacy strategy around beta blocker versus CMI, in this case, aficamten, MAPLE-HCM. Tell us a little bit about what that trial showed and the implications for that in terms of how we may be approaching the algorithm, the treatment algorithm that we spoke about earlier based on those results.
Yeah, really an eye-opening study in many ways. And what it showed was that in comparison to a beta blocker, aficamten really had a much more substantial improvement in symptoms. But primary endpoint was peak VO2 and a substantial improvement of aficamten with peak VO2 as well. And I think notably to me, also was looking at gradient reduction, really aficamten, as we spoke about, really has the ability to substantially get rid of obstruction. Well, there was really no change in gradients for patients on beta blocker therapy in that study.
Yeah, that was really the most surprising thing for me, that beta blockers, we've been using them for, again, half a century, didn't have any real effect at lowering gradients. And I think that translated into why you didn't really see much of an improvement in how patients felt with beta blocker compared to aficamten. And the other big kind of point, and you mentioned it, was that exercise capacity actually got worse on beta blocker compared to improved with aficamten. Why was that?
Yeah, I think that just shows to a principle that you need to think about when treating your patients as well, is the potential for beta blockers causing too much chronotropic incompetence. And with beta blockers, average heart rate with exercise over the course of treatment actually decreased by 20 beats per minute. So I think a lot of that in terms of lowering or worsening of peak VO2 with beta blockers was secondary to chronotropic effects.
Okay, good. So given, so to summarize that, just given the superiority in a way of aficamten over metoprolol in terms of the, again, the measures, the clinical measures that we value perhaps the most for our patients, making them feel better and function better, aficamten was superior to metoprolol and perhaps gives rationale really to potentially considering, certainly in certain select patients for sure, the option perhaps of earlier myosin inhibitor therapy in that treatment algorithm than we're currently practicing. Would you sort of agree with that statement?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think it's we're not yet at the point where we've abandoned beta blockers for treating obstructive HCM. I think it's still first-line therapy. Very safe drug, very inexpensive drug. So I think it's still worth a trial, but I definitely think we're at a point where we should move on from beta blockers quickly when they're not helping.
That's a good point.
And I think that, you know, with evolution in time, we're going to probably see at some point myosin inhibitors becoming first-line therapy as well, but not sure we're there yet.
Okay. Fair enough. And just so for everybody listening, again, we're talking about beta blockers here, at least in the context of to improve symptoms. We're not talking about beta blockers in obstructive HCM patients that you may want to consider the beta blocker for rate, for example, rate control for atrial fibrillation if a patient has that, or hypertension or other reasons. We're talking about symptom benefit, correct?
Correct. Completely.
Okay, good. Well, thank you very much for that. That was great insight.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Marty.
And thank you very much to our audience for watching. We really appreciate it.
And that's today's special spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PureDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at PureDirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions, please leave us a review on your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@PureDirect.com. Listen and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup or just ask, what's my flash briefing? Thanks today to our guests, Drs. Marin and Rowan. Join me next time for the episode where we'll cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.